So, before I start on the technical part, the tuning of the OpenBSD network stack and PF, I will have to correct your idea of history, which is Western propaganda. The computer was really founded, invented in 1993 in Soviet Union, by Commander Nikita Khrushchev. Of course, Georg Kaufmann was there and wrote this in Zimbabwe, because he figured out the truth of bullshit years ago. The program you had already before that one was pretty much cool.
2 years later,
a guy called Peter Adam invented OpenBSD. Of course, Georg Kaufmann was there, he became the first developer. In 1997, he had an argument with Bill and left OpenBSD and founded BSD Atlas 14, or sorry, that BSD with a few others. And back then, OpenBSD came with IPF as firewall. IPF had some problems. It was written by an author, so everything was upside down. We successfully forgot most of the technical issues, but there were many. The code was not up to our standards. It basically always fell over when you have 8,000 states, and well, we forgot most of that, fortunately. In 2001, the Aussie played games with the license. And yeah, well, we could use the chip in the end of May.
Just a little bit later,
the ethics tree. Back then, it was mostly an IPF clone. It was faster than IPF in the first release that of OpenBSD that had PF. And since we are more developers, and we are better developers, it was quickly way more powerful than IPF as well. And from that time on, OpenBSD and PF could always easily withstand comparison with other OSs and firewall packages. It was not always the fastest, proper slowest to get the idea, so it was all right. And these days, we actually have a nice process in the group.
So,
given that, why are we supposed to tune that? Well, first, because we can. We want people to replace so-called hardware routers, which are usually share the same design PC running some operating system has as well. The only routers that really separate control and data plane are in the six-digit setup. If we are faster, we are able to have firewalls in more places that can't have any today because of performance reasons. And the CPU cycles you save in the firewall grid, you can use for something else, like more crypto, playing info music, something like that.
And proxies, but not in the kernel. So, before tuning, you have to understand what you're going to tune.
Randomly pushing buttons is not going to help you, not for nops. Blindly making changes, if you're lucky, they are just pointless. Usually, or often, they are outright dangerous, so don't do it.
If you want to hack on the network, you have to understand MBUFs.
MBUFs are pre-allocated buffers in the kernel. They are 256 bytes on OpenBSD. They traditionally were 128 bytes only. They are still on one other unnamed BSD, and they suffer a lot.
There's a picture.
That's MBUFs on the pool.
The MBUF header
is, well, as the name indicates. That was not a question. As the name indicates, the MBUF header is in the beginning of each MBUF. It has pointers for the chaining and to form a queue. It has a pointer to the data associated. It has a length, a type, and a transfer.
Some flags. There are three kinds of MBUFs that we care about. There are more than three, but we only care about three right now. One is holding data itself, one is pointing to external data storage, and one is a packet header. I'm going to detail that. The easiest case is the MBUF that just holds data itself. You have the header followed by data. Then you can have MBUFs pointing to external data storage. Since 256 bytes is not all that much, you can use external data storage. External, or pointing elsewhere, in our case, usually is an MBUF cluster. MBAF clusters are just like MBAFs. They are pre-allocated data structures, or, well, no, buffers. They're just bigger. They are 2 kilobytes and thus big enough to fit an entire Ethernet frame, ignoring jumbos, as everybody does. We actually have bigger clusters as well. So clusters come from a pool as well. Clusters are bigger, the pool is bigger. The packet header MBAF is the most interesting one. That's always the first one in an MBAF chain that describes a packet. After the MBAF header has a second header, the packet header, that has more information about the packet. It has a pointer to the interface it was received on, it carries MBAF tags, the checksumming flags if the hardware supports checksum offloading, it has a VLAN tag and a bit more that I'm going to ignore here. And even if the MBAF is a packet header MBAF, it can still point to external storage or carry data itself. This nice data structure list describes an entire MBAF. Welcome to the union. It's sometimes really hard to deal with that stuff. So, picture.
This is the easiest case. We have one packet that fits in one regular MBAF completely. You have the header, you have the packet header, followed by the data, that's it, no more.
The
very uncommon case of an MBAF pointing to another MBAF that just has data. This would be a packet that's small enough to fit in the data area of those two MBAFs, but not bigger. You never chain three. By that time, you point,
third case that I'm going to show now, to an MBAF cluster.
This is the most commonly seen case because the RX links of the network interface parts are usually built from MBAF clusters. So even tiny packets like TCP end up in a cluster and the MBAF point to it is constructed later. And the little data area in the MBAF you could theoretically use, but you can't really because you only have one data pointer, so it's pointless.
So, now that you understood MBAFs, you're all network hackers, welcome to my world.
And you're going to travel through the kernel, taking the same route that the packets usually take. For this, to keep it somewhat easy, I'm assuming Ethernet, IPv4, no encapsulation of any form, right? No IPv6, that sucks anyway, no VLANs, no PPPoE, no IPsec, and no other crappy encapsulation protocols.
So fasten your seatbelts, packet travel.
First, the packet is received by the network interface card. The network interface card hardware DMAs it into the RAM that the provider provides. There are network interface cards that don't do DMA, but that's from last century, you're not going to use them. And today, even the stupid cheap ones do DMA. Sometimes they do it so stupidly that it doesn't pay out, but that's another story. As mentioned, the RX ring is usually built from MBAF clusters. The driver has to set that up beforehand. And as usual, we ignore jumbos again. And details differ a lot between different hardware. There's some that have multiple receive rings and stuff, but let's keep it easy. So once that happened, the network interface card interrupts to notify the CPU that something is there to be processed. And all half-reasonable network interface cards do not interrupt per packet, but for a bunch of packets at once. Details differ, ignore. So, CPU handles the interrupt sooner or later, depending on other activity in the system. And the interrupt handler calls back into the registered drivers for the interrupt. So we eventually end up in the driver for our network interface card. The handler calls Ether input, which does the Ethernet magic. It gets a pointer to the interface the packet was received on. There still is a pointer to a struct Ether header, which no driver today fills. Of course, Ether input just figures it out itself. And of course, a pointer to the MBAF from the RX ring, or really the MBAF pointing to a cluster.
Ether input does the Ethernet magic and eventually figures out we're dealing with IPv4 and places the MBUF in the IP interrupt queue. It then asserts a soft interrupt. When the CPU is done with all hard interrupts, it handles soft interrupts. This is technically not 100% correct, but that's what it comes down to. We end up in a function called IPinter, which dequeues the oldest packet from the IP interrupt queue and gives it to IPv4 input. IPv4 input does a lot of magic, and a lot of that stuff is only good for local deliveries, and I'm going to ignore those. First, it does some validation, like it checks that the packet is actually big enough to hold an IP header, it verifies the checksums, stuff like that. Then it calls PF test, which is the entry point to PF, and checks for multicast, broadcast, stuff like that, IPsec. Then a surprisingly expensive step, the decision whether the packet is to be delivered locally or to be forwarded. If it is not to be locally delivered, like the destination address is not local, then we call whether IP forwarding is enabled, and if so, call IP forward. And if not, we proceed with local delivery or drop the packet. IP forward is not all that complicated. It obviously does a route lookup. Good morning, Oga. I figured the experts out myself.
Okay,
IP forward obviously does a route lookup. It does the ICMP redirect games if that is required, and then calls IP output. If IP output signals failure, it also has to handle the generation of ICMP errors. IP outputs, again, does a lot of stuff that is irrelevant for all packets, and I'm going to skip that. It does all the MTU magic, including path MTU discovery. Fragmentation is required in any way. You can largely ignore that because MTU is 1500 period. Everything else is your imagination. Multicast, broadcast stuff, we ignore that. IPsec, we ignore that. And eventually, calls PF test again to let PF do its work on the outgoing side of things. IP output eventually calls the interface output routine for the interface where the packet is going to leave the system. Again, there's a lot of difference between different hardware. The output routine basically always makes the next send of the data out, and somewhere afterwards the hardware is going to interrupt to signal completion. So, we arrived. Questions so far? Okay. So, we now start performance hacking. Low-hanging fruit first, because there's lots of explanation of the more complicated stuff. The first thing I did in 2007 at the Ecofon, I think. If we do not use IPsec at all, there's no point in recursing into the IPsec layer to find out whether the packet might be IPsec. So we just stopped doing that, which is a very simple change, and maybe 10 change lines of code, and the gain is like 5% in forwarding rate. The stealth firewall issue that I found shortly afterwards, there are people who believe in stealth invisible firewalls, which of course is bullshit. Basically, you build an OpenBSD bridge around the Ethernet. And if, and only if, you configure PF to send TCP RSTs or ICMP errors when it drops the packet, which kind of defeats the purpose of an invisible firewall anyway, if you do that, there's a way to prove that your invisible firewall is there. Basically, you send a TCP or a UDP packet to the host behind your bridge that has the protocol checksum, the TCP or the UDP checksum, corrupt. The end host receiving that packet will drop it because the checksum is not correct, right? If
your bridge drops it because your rootset says it has to be dropped, and your rootset says to send an ICMP error back or a TCP RFC, the firewall will do so. So that's the difference. The end host will not reply. If you configure your system so incorrectly, it will. And your visible firewall is not all that invisible anymore.
There's no point to be invisible in the first place, but that's another discussion. So, unfortunately, there was a solution to that problem added to PF. The solution was to check the protocol checksum on each and every forward package. Yes. The performance for that is not nice. So the solution I picked is that we only actually ever look at the protocol checksum if we are about to send back the TCP RFC or the ICMP error, and not at all anymore for packets we just forward. This gives 7% of gain in forwarding rate almost for free. Time. Getting the current time is surprisingly expensive, especially on older i36 machines that just have the traditional timer chip. It's really expensive to access that. OpenBSD will use any other timer available in your system if it's there. But if you have older PCs that just have this timer chip, getting the time is really, really expensive. We used to timestamp the pools that are the backend for MF and MF clusters, not only them, but all of them. We used to timestamp the pools when something puts memory back into it, basically freeze memory. And it turned out this is just not necessary. This was collecting statistics that were not exposed anywhere, so they were useless. So we just removed that timestamping, and the gain of forwarding rate is very, very hardware dependent, but it was on some machines in the two-digit range, like more than 10%. Second change, down to same microphone, 2007. We used to stir the kernel random pool, that's the backend for all the randomness functions, once per packet. And stirring, there we are again, requires clock reading. Now we only stir per interrupt. Massive improvement, like 15-20%. Again, depends on the hardware. And it turned out this is also better for the randomness, because the timing of 5 packets and 1 interrupt after each other is pretty predictable, because the time to process 1 packet is pretty stable, predictable. The timing of the interrupts, less so. So this actually improved the kernel random pool.
PF is called twice for forward packet, right? Once inbound, once outbound. And between those two invocations, PF needs to remember some stuff. The queue ID for alt queue, you can set that inbound, but the queue happens outbound. So this has to be remembered. Also has to be passed down to alt queue, which is not internally technically part of PF. Well, partially, but the actual queuing engine is not. The tag, in the sense of the tag and tag keywords, the routing table ID for the multiple routing tables, or for these days, domains. This is really cool stuff for a separate talk. The loop prevention for route 2 is basically a counter that we increase every time we route a packet. And if we did it too often, we drop it. Some magic for the only congestion notification. And yeah, flags for various stuff. So that information used to sit in MBOF flags, which I unfortunately now have to understand. Explain. I understand that. Explain. So when you travel, you give up your luggage. Surprisingly, you sometimes get a bag, except you're in Europe. The airline will attach a label to your bag for their own purposes, so they can track it. And this is exactly what MBOF tags are. We basically attach an external label to our MBOF. The MBOF packet header has the head structure for the queue. The MBOF tags form a queue. You can have more than one MBOF tag per MBOF. They form a queue, and the MBOF tag itself is a struct that has the queue magic, an ID, the length, and the data itself.
Yeah. So, this is really nice and simple.
But, well, those tags have to be stored somewhere, so you need memory. And so if you need memory, use malloc, right? If you listened to AutoStore yesterday, you know that malloc is not simple. This is kernel malloc, which is completely different, but it's not simple either.
Less simple.
It's a bit less simple, yes. Let's not go down that road. It's not simple. Here. So, this malloc turned out to be our performance bottleneck. And now the warning is in order. Do not ever try to improve your performance by bypassing malloc. You will fail. Many people try it. Eventually, they all fail. Don't do it. This case is just very, very, very special. So please don't even think about it. So, our solution? We put the stuff that PF needs to remember right into the packet header, which means that we grow the packet header a little bit and waste a little bit of memory if PF is not actually in use. But it's not much, and we're very willing to take it. In practice, it's not even it. I removed some stuff that PF used to remember. This was done in a cache style, like calculate once and reuse later. And it turned out it's actually faster to recalculate than to access the memory to get the pre-calculated value.
And yeah, down there you see the structure that we added to the packet header. Consequences of that.
The test set up to verify that change was the Darkslow circuit that has really shitty memory interface sucks. Was configured as bridge. Bridge sucks, but it's perfect for benchmarking because no queuing happens. Like, no packets will be dropped, it just forwards at the rate that it can. Which in real life sucks, but for benchmarking it's perfect. One stateful pass rule and nothing else. And we made a single TCP connection through it, pushing as much traffic as we could. Before we changed the MF tags, the PF stuff, put it in MF tags, the box to 28 megabits a second, afterwards 56, twice as much, really nice.
Yep. So this is an information, which is the size of, or the mean size of the second
One direction 1500, other direction only X.
So very little.
But one direction full size, other direction only the X. By the way, at the end that we have of the hexagon box did the same test as I did. So really nice performance doubles for,
well, not a simple change, but well, performance doubled. Okay, that's the low-hanging fruit, unfortunately.
The other changes are not just implementation fixes, improvements, whatever. We need to start redesigning. The first thing we redesigned, this was mostly done by Ryan and me. We started 4 years ago on a ferry ride, and it took us 2 years to actually start on it. But, well, now we're there. So the first victim, the PF state table.
Which means I have to explain it now. As you probably all know, PF stateful tracks connections. It's kind of obvious for TCP, which is stateful by definition. For UDP and everything else, we just take state on top. Stateful filtering is wanted for security reasons, but it's also way, 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 way faster. If you take transatlantic travel as an analogy, the rule set lookup is a small boat, and the state lookup is an airplane, a really fast one. The network address translation and interface bound states, of course, complicate things quite a bit because, well, network interface address, network address translation, as the name indicates, changes addresses. And interface bound states have to take precedence over the grid ones, the floating ones. The PF state table used to be pretty flat. It was one state struct and a large RD tree.
Each of the state entities, PF states, had three addresses to account for the network address translation. Right, you have the two originals and the one changed. This is the reason why you only ever could do NAT inbound and redirect outbound, because we only had one address to change. But there wasn't just one state table, there was one global one and one bound to each interface. And the interface one was for the interface bound states and had been consulted before you even look at the global one where the state usually lives, even if you don't use interface bound states, which nobody halfway sane does.
Okay, you need them for IPsec, but nobody halfway safe uses those.
So, start redesigning. We split the state into the key and the rest. The key being the fields used to find the state. That is the addresses, the address family, I think before, I think we should. That's basically all we support, yeah. And the protocol.
And of course the ports. And each key doesn't just point to a state, it holds a queue of states.
That's what it looks like. The mentioned three addresses, the three ports belong to the addresses, the address family, the protocol, and the pointer to the list of states. In this setup, the queue matcher could actually live in the state. You will see soon why it doesn't anymore.
So, the extra state tables per interface, we don't need them anymore, we can kill them. Colliding state entries, meaning state entries that have the same addresses and ports, can now just hang off the same state key. The interface bound states are always inserted into the queue head, and the floating ones at the queue tail. So the interface bound ones are, by definition, always in front of the floating ones. So our lookup becomes really easy. We found our state key. We walk the list of states, and usually there's just one, so this is cheap. We walk the list of chains of states, and just look at the interface pointer at the state. If the interface pointer is the same or pointing to the interface we are working on, we found a state. If it's not, go on. If the interface pointer on the state is not set, it's loading, okay, we're done, we'll take that. This gives a fair performance boost. We didn't really measure it back then because it was just an intermediate step. And we know it's faster. Then we have this wonderful NPK9, the NAPA Hackathon in Japan, in Ito. There, the big changes happened. We got rid of the annoying triple errors thing that was really hard to follow even for us. And now the state key just has two errors, a source and destination. But since both source and destination depend on the direction you look at things, we just call them errors 1 and 2. Same thing for ports, obviously. And each state now has two state key pointers. One we call wire site and one we call stack site. This is best explained on the next slide.
Then we process a packet. It arrives, we go to IPv4 input, and this calls it free address. No changes to addresses could have happened so far. This is what we call a wire site. The packet is what it was on the wire. Then PF manages it, could do network address translation, and gives it back to IPv4 input. Now, changes to the addresses could have happened if NAT is in place. And we call this stack site. Then we go to IPv4 and end up at IP output and PF again. Now, state site is where the packet comes from, because we are now dealing with the outbound direction. It might rewrite an address again, and then we're on buyer side again.
Okay.
If there's no NAT, things are really easy. The state key points to the state item, pointing to the state, and both my state key pointers point back to my one state key, because the addresses are the same, right?
If there's NAT going on,
the pointers are different. Now you see why the state items have to be separate. The fire site state key pointer points to one, and the stack site points to another state key, because the addresses are not the same,
right? So,
for this state to work out, the state operations, like search, insert, and delete, that are done from the stack side, then PF is running outbound, have to be done with the addresses and ports reversed, because otherwise the return traffic will never match. This, figuring this out is not easy, it's complicated. Please just believe us, it's right, it took lots of alcohol to recover from those discussions.
If you want, you can take a whiteboard and do the work that we did. For inspiration, that's ours. Don't forget the cloud. So, now, by definition, the forward connection, the the inbound stack side state key must be the exact opposite of the stack side state key on the outbound side, by definition, because the address cannot change in between. The only way is tunneling stuff, but this is easy to handle. And since you always look up reversed on the outbound side, they are the opposite of each other by definition. If you can form a relationship between those two, like have them point to each other, and remember the state key used on the inbound side, we don't have to do a state search on the outbound side. We can just follow the pointer, right? It's not as trivial as it sounds, but no. No reason to not do it. So, you just add the pointer called reverse to the state key that points to the counterpart, and vice versa, right?
So,
back to MBUS, where we put the PF stuff in the packet header, we just extend that by another field pointer to our state key, and now we can remember the state key, right? So, inbound, when we found our state, we just store the pointer to the state key right in the MBUS. On outbound side, no lookups. If we are outbound and the state key is set and the state key has a reverse pointer, use it. Period. No more lookups.
Then I did a benchmark, and it was very frustrating. It was only 10% faster. We expected much, much, much more. So, very frustrating. Going to do something else for a while helps. So, overview on the results. 10% is actually nice, and this is groundwork for a lot of other stuff that we wanted to do. With the linking, we suddenly have a notion of flows in the kernel. And there are many other subsystems that have their own notion of flows or their own way of keeping state. An obvious example are the TCP and UDP stacks. And there's other subsystems that do not keep state, but they could profit a lot. Good example for that later. So, TCP and UDP stacks first. Obviously, they have to track connections, which is their way of keeping state. For that, they use so-called protocol control blocks, prefixed by the address family, so it's an in-PCB. And you can just use the PF state key to keep track of that. Just add pointer to the in-PCB to the state key. Before we do search the in-PCB in the TCP internals, we just check for the state key if it's set, check whether the pointer is set, if so, use it. If we had to search because it was not set, we just link the two. We set the pointer in the state key to the in-PCB, and the in-PCB gets a pointer back to the state key because it is not shown here. When one of them goes away, either the state key or the in-PCB, the link has to be broken, obviously. Otherwise, you just get crap pointers. The other example of a subsystem that does not keep state but could profit a lot is the routing code. Right now, we have to do a route lookup per packet. And especially on full PGP routers, your routing table is not exactly small. 300,000 entries is the norm today. So if we store a pointer to the route used in our state key, we only have to look up once for the first packet, but never ever again. We can just follow the point, right? This should give a fair performance gain. There's a tiny little problem, though. Routes change, they go away, more specific routes are added. How are we going to do this? We can do it. Routes must simply not be deleted. This turns out to be easy because they are ref-mounted already. Instead, this is what we do. They are flagged invalid, removed from the table, but are still around until the ref count drops to zero. If it's zero, drop it. Leaves the more specific problem. This is not easy to explain, but I'll try anyway.
Assume the destination address is 10.0.0.1. And the route lookup gave us the default route. We link the default route into our state key, right?
So now somebody adds a route to 10/24. If we did a new lookup, we would find this route because it's the most specific match. But our state key points to the default route, and the default route is still valid, so we are going to use it incorrectly. There's a solution, but there are dragons waiting. Before inserting a new route, or actually while inserting, find the less specific. So if we insert 10/24, basically do lookup for 10/24 just before we insert it. And this will find us the same default route that we have linked to our state. Then we have to remove the default route from the table, make a copy, insert the copy to the table again, and mark the just removed one invalid. Now the state key points to the copy that has the invalid flag on it. And then it must just not use the pointer, but do a new lookup and write the new result into the state key. Problem solved. Well, except the routing code, no sorry, the routing table code, the Radix code is a mess, and this has yet to be done. Something different. BF has this wonderful, wonderful TCP connection tracker. This is one of the strongest traits. It looks at the TCP flags and moves the state forward, right? Like established or timing out, all that shit. And this is the important part. It verifies the TCP sequence numbers against the negotiated window. This, of course, cannot work if your firewall only sees packets in one direction. Like from A to B, it goes through a firewall. From B to A, it takes another route. The problem is that PF doesn't see the window size announcements, at least not from both sides, so it does not have an idea what the window actually is, and it assumes the default window, which is small.
To work around that, I implemented a sloppy tracker that does the bare minimum by just looking at the TCP flags, nothing else, not even touching the sequence number, and please don't use the code I wrote.
Well, not in general, but this one. This is really only for this circumstance that you have asymmetric routing you have to deal with. This is uncommon on the edge, like where most of you probably have the firewalls. It is not uncommon in the internet core. Of course, they don't have influence about routing to the point that you can expect symmetry.
And yeah, as said, don't use it unless you absolutely have to. So, the full-blown tracker does a lot more than the sloppy one, so I expected the sloppy one to be faster.
Just to give you an idea, the full-blown one is 320 something lines of code, and the sloppy one is 69. You don't want to use only firewall, but for forward connection, it suffices to do the sequence number check on one side, right? There's no point in checking inbound and outbound, it will not have changed.
So we have our shiny new state key linking.
If there is the pointer there, it's obviously a forward flag, right? So when we establish the linking between those two, we mark one of the states as sloppy, the curve auto sloppy came out. The other side will be the sequence number, of course. So benchmark time and all the frustration, it's lower. Why? Trying to narrow it down, bench sloppy tracker on both sides versus full blown on both sides, and well, surprisingly, there is no difference at all.
What's the lesson from that? It should be faster, right? It does less.
The limiting factor is not the CPU cycles in the sense of the integer units. It's not the math. That's not the limiting factor. The limiting factor is memory access, data access. So while the sloppy one spins doing nothing, waiting for data, the full-blown one verifies the TCP window.
So this is the explanation why they are equally fast. This does not explain why sloppy on one side and the full-blown one on the other side are actually slower.
Our theory, this is hard to prove, but our theory is that the reason is instruction path correction. Lesson from that, tiny code helps. to XML on my controls does not. And needless to say, my shiny auto sloppy code went directly to dev not.
Waste of time, but we learned a lesson. I'm almost at the end now. Of course, since then, development didn't stop. We had this nice network kernel hackathon, or network hackathon in Basel in early 2009, where I rewrote the scrub parts of PF, it has fragment reassembly and TTL modification and stuff like that. We had the general hackathon in Edmonton, where I wrote a horrible dude that I just committed. Horrible because it's like 4,000 lines. It's the rewrite of the entire net code in PF. Catch a copy of current hearing, figure it out. I think it's really nice. And try to break it. I want bug reports. There must be bugs in there. And just a few weeks ago, we had a file system hackathon in Stockholm that was really a kernel hackathon. There are various little things. Last but not least, I implemented the RUP stuff that I just talked about, minus the more specific problem that I want another developer to do. all this is material for future talks because we don't have time anymore. Questions? Too dirty, way too dirty. More questions?
No, just pictures. Was it too easy or too hard?
I don't know, not many developers, you know.
Apparently. Okay, everybody.